side by side with purification, which we discussed at considerable length last time, comes concentration. Sri Aurobindo describes purification and concentration as the feminine and the masculine aspects of the process of yoga. Purification without concentration tends to remain a mere quietude. It is only if purification is backed up by concentration and made use of by the process of concentration that it yields its full results. Most of the impurity in an individual is due to this fact that there is no willed concentration of the faculties of the mind or of the heart. Man stands exposed to whatever impacts come upon him in the world, and it is only his surface mind that picks up a few contacts and establishes some sort of connection, a working relation between the contacts. Pell-mell. The contacts are unregulated, and the relations that are established are equally pell-mell. That is why there is such a disharmony, imbalance in the normal individual. A seeker, one who seeks to regulate his life in accord with an ideal, has perforce to impose some sort of order on the functioning of his faculties. Some sort of order again on the way in which the mind coordinates the contacts to which one is exposed or which one chooses. And this is where concentration is indispensable. Concentration, broadly speaking, means a willed use of a faculty with which we are concerned at the moment. Speaking in the yogic context, however, the context of yoga with which we are concerned, concentration has a more limited connotation. It means the gathering of our thought from its involvement into the many-sided flow of mental activities and directing that thought to a purpose, to an objective that we have in view. It is a means by which thought is freed from its thraldom to the sense mind, to the restive logical mind which insists on pressing all experience into the mold of logic. The thoughts are gradually gathered, narrowed down. The thoughts are narrowed down into a thought, and in this thought so concentrated, one rises into the real. there are three powers to concentration. It functions in three different ways. First, by concentrating one's thought on an object, on a movement, one can force it to yield up its contents to be the object of one's knowledge. By sheer concentration upon an object, one makes an impact on the consciousness that is involved in the object and forces it to release the knowledge of its content to the subject who concentrates upon it. That is one. Second, by concentrating the will, it is possible, if only one would persevere without possible disappointments, to acquire what one does not have. One may not have something, one may want to acquire it. If one masses one's will and directs it upon that object of acquiring the thing that one wishes to have, one day the will acts upon the situation and the thing comes in possession of the subject. There is another concentration, that is, by turning the concentration on a particular status of the being, it is possible to make it real, to organize it and make it a permanent part of our possession. Thus, for instance, if one is by nature a weakling, or due to environmental training, influences, one becomes afraid of things, fearful, nervous, weak, by concentrating upon a state of health, of body, that one is strong, there is a part in me which is strong, which can acquire strength. By concentrating upon that status, state of being, it is possible for a weakling to develop into a giant of strength, for a coward to grow into a hero. These are three processes of concentration. Concentration of thought, concentration of will, concentration on the being. These three may be utilized separately or together. This process of threefold concentration, however, has certain well-marked gradations. There is first the step of purification, the second one of renunciation of activity that is foreign to the object of concentration. Third, cessation of all activity which is not directly connected with the object of concentration. Concentration upon an object, the consciousness seizes the object, of course seizes mentally. After seizing, the problem is to hold it in one's attention. After holding it, for the consciousness to lose itself in the object, to become one with the consciousness in the object. This process, this discipline of concentration has been standardized and notably systematized in the Raja Yoga of Patanjali. As all of you are aware, the first two steps of this eightfold path of yoga are of purification, purification external and internal, cleanliness outer and inner, training of the will Godward, disciplining of the mind in the ways of holiness and purity. If these two steps, two limbs are indispensable indeed, whatever the yoga that you choose. I have heard it lightly said that in our integral yoga, which is advanced, modern, there is no need to observe the preliminary limbs of the Raja Yoga. The truth is to the contrary. Sri Aurobindo and the mother take it for granted that one who chooses such a difficult ideal as the transformation of nature, the divinization of oneself, have perforce gone through that preliminary discipline. It is understood that one does not need to be put through that mill. After all, the purification, the process of the two first limbs, Yama and Niyama, are largely psychological, and unless one is psychologically equipped in that sense, it is impossible to make any headway in any yoga, much less the integral yoga, which demands more of man than any other does. After one has purified oneself, eliminated the dross of inertia, tamas, proclivities to lower movements, cleansed oneself of soul, comes the third, the step of posture, asana. Here again, they speak of as many as 84 postures. They are not relevant to our purpose. Patanjali himself says that posture is ideal for you in which you are at ease. The position in which you can hold yourself for a considerable length of time without discomfort, the position in which permits an uninterrupted flow of the life force, the nerve force into the nerve channels, in which you can sit without feeling any kind of pain or muscular discomfort for any length of time, that is the ideal asana for you. Normally, all that is required is that one sits erect without resting the head, backwards or forwards. We see number of people near the samadhi who sit with their head bent on their knees. That, I am afraid, is hardly the posture for meditation or concentration. It induces a certain lethargy, promotes sleep. It may be physically comfortable, but yogically it is inadvisable. Similarly, during meditation or concentration, one shall not rest the head on the wall or the chair. One may do it when one is contemplating, when one is in a relaxed condition. One is in a relaxed condition, partly meditating, partly thinking. But serious concentration and serious meditation does not permit. It requires that the tip of the nose, the chest and the spine, all the three are in a straight line. In number of Upanishads you will find this posture described as the ideal. There is the three centers have to be in a line, so that the breath goes from top to toe, from top to the abdomen, from the head to the abdomen, in a straight direction. There is no dissipation of life energy. Posture achieved. Next, there is the regulation of breath. There is an intimate connection, as you know, between breathing and thoughts. When the mind is restless, the mind is furiously thinking, the breathing also is fast. Similarly, when the breathing is hard, the mind is agitated. So the ancients discovered that by regulating the breath, one can regulate the flow of activities in the mind. They asked the seeker to slow down gradually the breathing, the rate of breathing. As you slow down, as you establish a certain rhythm in the incoming and the outgoing breath, the working of the mind, the flow of thoughts, they also fall into a certain pattern. The mind comes under control. This principle of the regulation of thought by the regulation of breath was developed into a fine science called pranayama, the elongation of breath. That again is a different science which has more than yogic results, into which we need not enter today. This done, the posture taken, the mind brought into a minimum control by breathing, by the regulation of breathing, the next step is to withdraw our mental faculties, which are spread in 100 directions. What is called in the ancient science pratyahara. Turn it towards yourself. Give it food here, don't allow it to pick up food outside. This turning inward of the mental faculties, of the sense mind, of the perceptive mind, this is the next step. Once all the outspread faculties of the mind are gradually gathered and turned inward, they are massed together on the point of, on the object of concentration. It may be a name, it may be a form, it may be a sound. Around that, all the mental energies and faculties are gathered, narrowed and narrowed, and made to converge on that idea or form or sound. That is called concentration. In the very nature of things, it is not possible to keep up this tension, this state of concentration for long. With their fine science, fine knowledge of human psychology, human capacities, the ancients again prescribed that once you bring your whole consciousness at a point, hold it for a while on the object of concentration, the next step is to release the whole gathered consciousness on the theme of the object. It is to be allowed, the mind is to be allowed to flow, maybe in thoughts, maybe in ideas, but concerned and governed by that object. So, the concentration gradually flows into meditation. From fixation, there is a gradual, controlled, well-directed movement in terms of the chosen theme. As the mind is first freed from outer objects, it is brought to an inner object. Thereafter, thought is allowed, the play of thoughts. As thought flows on the subject, gradually the mind of the consciousness acquires the character of the object meditated upon. It becomes one with it, and when all external existence is put by, all internal consciousness is merged in the object, that begins the first stage of what is called samadhi or the trance. Here again, there is first the awareness that I am the knower and this is the known. Gradually, that consciousness of the distinction between the knower and the known gradually gets vague, and one is no more, the knower is no more. Only the object is there. One loses oneself into the object. If, for instance, one chooses the theme of the divine as love, once you bring the mind into focus and think of love, the divine love, after thinking of it, you come to the essence of love, God as love. What is love? How God manifests? The qualities of love? These are the processes of analyzing and understanding for yourself the implications of conceiving the divine as love. As you think of it, the process travels from the mind to the heart, from the heart to the rest of the being, so that not only the mind is full of the concept, working out the concept of the divine as love, but there is a spontaneous ebullition of love for God, of love for all, God in all. There is either a simultaneous or a successive experience of love in the mind, love in the heart. The very body, through the pores of the body, oozes out vibrations of love. When you come in the presence of such a person, you feel warmed up. You feel like loving everybody. All orders of creation. You see a tree, you see a flower, love flows from you. You don't need to force yourself to do it or imagine that. In the presence of divine love, one cannot but love whatever comes in the ambience of one's consciousness. Similarly, if you conceive of the divine as power, you first understand the power aspect of the divine, followed by an infusion of strength and power into your own being. These are successive steps, or as I said, simultaneous happenings in effective concentrations. Concentration naturally needs, at any rate in the beginning, some support. One may choose a thought, an idea, or a form, or a name. It is understood that whichever you select, thought, idea, form, or name, it is only the starting point. It is a springboard to soar or to delve into that which is behind the thought, the form, or the name. The name stands for something. The form symbolizes some reality. Thought is a projection of a greater reality than what is translated in the mental figure. So using them, the attempt is always to get beyond to what one begins with. For instance, a name, it is understood that these practices are not superstitions. Dry philosophers may pride themselves and in the vanity of their knowledge may say that repetition of names, japa, or mantras, having forms, idolatrous, image, worship, all these, it is very irresponsible attitude to regard them as superstitions. They are facts of spiritual experience, of the symbolic word Om as a sure means of soaring out of the phenomenal into the real. There is one whole Upanishad, one of the classical Upanishads, the Mandukya, which is devoted to an exposition, a systematic exposition of the components of the sound. A-U-M in English. Each three parts, the first part releasing vibrations that are relevant to the waking condition. To the outer world, the second relating to the subtler world of dream, where things are still planned, organized, given subtle shapes before they are projected into the material. Third, where things are in a seed state, sleeping, the sleeping condition, the waking condition, the dream state and the sleep state and the sleep state, and all together A-U-M rising into a potent sound, into that which exceeds all the states, the transcendent, the fourth state. So if one repeats this charged world in course of time, the whole being quietens down. All the restless energies fall into a certain silence, and one begins to get liberated into the infinity. Om is the one word that does not need to be communicated by the guru, by a guru. It is very good indeed if a guru gives it, imparts it, but even otherwise, it has become a self-existent mantra. Millions have repeated it and added their force of consciousness to the sound vibrations of the world. And Om is, you must remember, the nearest approximation in terms of human sound, sound which can be received by the physical ear on the human plane. It is the nearest approximation on the earth plane to the primordial sound, vibration, nada, which is said to have issued when the creative consciousness first stirred into movement before this manifestation came out of the bosom of the eternal. There is a particular vibration on that supernal plane of existence. Translated, rendered into human terms, Om is the word which approximates nearest to it. So by repeating that word, one reforges a link with that primordial vibration, where the existence is infinite, where the consciousness is luminous, where the bliss is ever flowing. That is the importance of Om. There are indeed other words, particularly in the tantras, called the seed letters, which establish communication with their relevant powers, cosmic powers, smaller deities, indifferent power, godlings, There are seed sounds, but we need not go into that subject today. I was saying that when you take a form, a name or a sound, the objective must be always to reach behind the sound, beyond the form. Name and form sum up certain characteristics of the reality that is related to that name and that form. Name is a power, form is a symbol. Through either you can establish contact with the reality for which they stand, and in the process of concentration these have a capital use. By whichever means one persists and traverses the whole gamut of samadhi. Samadhi means a gathered state of consciousness in which it is one with the object that is concentrated upon. There is no movement. Even the movement, seed movement, is not there. This is the highest state where everything falls silent. One is just what one has concentrated upon. It is in that state, as in the water, still limpid water of a lake, that the reality reflects itself. That indeed is the goal of the traditional yoga. For us who believe not only in liberation but in fulfillment in the world, canalizing the results of the liberation into the world for its perfection, it is necessary to normalize that state of trance in waking life. How is that to be done? One starts again with a bifurcation of consciousness. There is a frontal part, always active, throwing itself into the movement or movements. But there is behind a status of consciousness which derives from that state of concentration where one reflects the higher reality. One receives without interruption a continuous infusion from the higher plane. So this waking state of samadhi, what Gita calls the natural samadhi, is our object. Concentration is a means, meditation is a means, samadhi, trance, is a means. The object is to normalize the highest state of consciousness that we can reach, make real to ourselves in peak periods of our concentration. Periods for this purpose are necessary, very much necessary, till one carries that poise all the 24 hours, working, sleeping or sitting or walking. It is a moving consciousness established in the poise of the eternal. That should be our object. How we are going to do it, what is the way to set about it, we will be discussing in our future meetings. Any questions?
If one wants to know about a particular aspect of some object, how do you direct that concentration without destroying the concentration?
Direct the concentration
to that aspect of the object.
First, one has a certain mental conception, right or not fully right. All the thoughts, the train of thoughts, are then directed with a will, without allowing the mind to stray on that theme. Possibility, there is always, the first steps are always speculation, rejection, discrimination. This thought is right, that thought is right. That way, there is an exercise of the mental faculties, exploring the possibilities, rejecting what is not likely. In every way, the consciousness is kept centered, and when a certain tenseness or a certain poise is developed, it attracts a response from the higher plane where there is an intuitive knowledge. When all the mind is gathered and ready to receive the relevant knowledge, a ray from that intuitive level touches the mind. To properly understand and interpret that communication, purification is required. Otherwise, the mind tends to read its own ideas. To put it simply, one has first to create a climate for the knowledge, true knowledge, to manifest. Prepare the background, create the necessary atmosphere, keep the whole being tuned to that. And it is understood that there is a certain call in the heart for that knowledge to come, and the response is bound to come. Sri Aurobindo did not use the method of concentration there at all. He was asked just to sit quiet, and he sat quiet. He just obeyed his teacher, the teacher, and he was told that when you are quiet, you will see thoughts coming from outside. Throw them out. So he says it was a new idea to him that thoughts could be coming out from outside, and he wanted to see, and immediately he saw thoughts coming with concrete impact from outside, and with will he just threw them aside. So this operation continued for 3 days, watching the thoughts and throwing them out, and the silence established itself. This does not and cannot happen to everybody. It was the presence and the dynamism of the person who was sent by God to put him in the line that was responsible. And of course, his own unquestioning obedience to the Guru. He did not use the process of concentration at all. He was just quiet and did what he was told. What happened was, as he was doing, the inner layers, the subtler layers of the mind, they came forward, and there was absolute peace, a state which never left him thereafter. the brain apparatus fell silent. Thereafter, the brain as such never worked. He says he never thought and wrote. He was always conscious, whether it was a letter, whether it was the Arya, whether it was life divine. It was always from above the higher mind that things were coming. The brain was a channel, but never something that formed, gave shape to the thoughts. The brain was a channel. So he did not arrive at silence or peace by concentration. But that can't be the rule. There are cases, no doubt, where people have stumbled upon silence without concentrating, without having to concentrate. Such cases you can explain that in their previous birth, they had arrived at that point of evolution where the silence of the mind or the being was nearing realization. Somehow, it was not completed. And some small incident, some small provocation is enough to light up that possibility in the present birth. When people speak of this sage or that sage, sudden getting realization in 5 minutes, it only means that a realization which had failed to fructify in the earlier incarnation gets fulfilled in the present. Sri Aurobindo was not an evolving being like us who had to do yoga and achieve spiritual evolution or liberation. He had to find and forge a new way for a new goal, and that is why, as a representative of Earth humanity, he did what he did. Even as the mother today is subjecting herself to the process of transformation, not as an individual, but as a representative of the Earth being, carrying all the obstructions and resistances that are still in the Earth consciousness, Earth nature, and exposing them to the force that is acting. Sri Aurobindo's yoga was done more as a representative than as a seeker. Whatever the tradition, whatever the age, concentration is the same. One cannot be rigid in these matters because certain things fall off after their use is over. I may be repeating a mantra or concentrating upon a particular form. If that exercise has fulfilled its purpose, given me the necessary poise or experience, it tends to drop itself. One cannot always stick to something which has outlived its purpose. This is a dynamic yoga, with fresh possibilities, fresh horizons coming every day. It is not as if we have one limited objective of seeing what is behind a particular form. If that is that objective, one can't give it up till one has come to the other side of the form. But for us, it is not the objective. We use these things as helps, supports for the gathering of our consciousness and delivering it into the hands of the yoga force, that is to achieve the change in us. We are not certainly expecting that individually we will be working out the whole process of transformation in ourselves. Our part is still, the surrender is complete, the receptivity is fully organized, the ego is eliminated, and the psychic is awakened. Thereafter, neither the process of concentration or meditation or samadhi is necessary. There is a natural efflorescence of spiritual development, because it is something else that takes charge. We have only to be supporting, cooperating, collaborating from our lower end. Many yogas in India particularly make these concentration and meditation ends in themselves, and that is where they fall short. These are not, worship is not an end in itself. Doing japa 1,000 times to 1 lakh of times is not an end in itself. All these things become mechanical. And the moment a thing becomes mechanical, that is a signal that you have to stop it. Unless you can revivify that process by a fresh spurt of emotion or aspiration, it is useless spiritually to persist with a process that has ceased to be living. To put it in another way, the approach to the divine is twofold. It can be either personal, in its personal aspect, or the impersonal. Impersonal, when you conceive of the divine, or for us, mother who is divine for us, we conceive and adore her as love, as compassion, as grace, as peace, as joy. One can think of her according to the situation, according to the difficulty, according to the need of the hour. But when she is available in a personal form, if we can establish a link by love, by surrender, by devotion, by adoration, with the person of the mother, then all these impersonal aspects of us respond according to our need, without our having to concentrate upon that aspect. If I am disturbed, if I am agitated, if only I think of mother with love, remember her, call her, that which is necessary to heal my agitation, the peace, the calm, that comes unasked. Her face, her frontal person is like a button, which if you press, it releases an immense reservoir of divine energies, flowings of consciousness in whatever aspect you pray for. Both are good, but to think of her in a personal way is quicker, more satisfying, and spiritually more rewarding.
What would you advise in a work situation in Oroville where the concentration has to be on the work itself, and yet one wants always to refer it to the divine, make it a progress?
This idea of progressing towards the divine, of growing in one's consciousness through work, it need not be hammered during the course of work. Before starting the work, one offers, one dedicates, one prays, aspires. Thereafter, the bulk of the concentration must be on work. The character of the work is different once you dedicate it. You have to concentrate upon making the work more and more perfect. The inner part, which is dedicated itself earlier, it goes on drawing. It goes on drawing the necessary guidance, the light, the energies, and pouring into you as you are working. So much so that the guidance is automatic, spontaneous. There is no tiredness normally, up to a certain level, up to a certain point. One part is always linked. That is what I always say. There has to be a bifurcation of consciousness at every level. But when you do work, you have to be concentrated only on work, because the whole basis is different for the work, and you should have the trust that you will be guided. When a challenge presents itself, then is the time to pause a little and look for the guidance. There, to catch the right guidance, purification is presupposed, that you don't allow your own preferences, choice, egoistic considerations, all these to interfere or parade under the guise of divine guidance. As Sri Aurobindo has said, the vital is a great charlatan, a dramatizer, and he can very well put on the cloak of the divine. It is a question of sincerity. The sincere work, even up to a certain stage wrongly done, is spiritually rewarding. But there must be sincerity. Somewhere, at some stage, the guidance comes through somebody or through your own awakening, and you correct yourself.